One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brush our teeth, yet most of us don't do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. Quip was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable. And now I have to do the thing where I'm honest with you. So Quip sent samples to me, and I was not around when the samples came. And so my husband was the one who started using Quip, and I've been doing these ads kind of based on his experience because they only sent the one sample. They sent another sample, and wow, this really is a cool toothbrush. Like, I knew that it was like a joy to use because it's beautiful. And like, I also knew, like, technically, like, has the sonic vibrations and it helps you brush your teeth correctly, but it feels really cool. I have incredibly sensitive gums. I've been using it for a few weeks now and my gums have not bled. God, I hope that's not too gross for this. I hope Quip is okay with me saying that. But anyway, I have sensitive gums. I'm sensitive in general. And this toothbrush has been great. And again, it's kind of just nice to use. It's a nice way to start your day, like by using something beautiful. Quip has a 2-minute timer that pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides. And Quip doesn't require a clunky charger. It runs for 3 months on one charge. And since 3 out of 4 of us use bristles that are old and worn out, Quip delivers a new brush head to you automatically on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months. That's about when the battery needs to be changed too, for just $5. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association. It has thousands of verified 5-star reviews. So that's why I love Quip. And dental professionals also love Quip. It's backed by over 20,000 of them. It starts at just $25. If you go to getquip.com/friends right now, you will get your first refill pack for free. That is with a Quip electric toothbrush. So again, it's getquip.com/friends, getquip.com/friends, and you will get your first refill pack for free. Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox. Welcome to With Friends Like These, the show where we talk about the differences between us without letting them divide us. This week's show is one of those where I get to cheat a bit and talk to a friend, talk to someone who I was really interested in talking to about this, even if I didn't have an excuse to record our hour-long conversation. I would talk to my friend Jamil Smith, who is a senior writer at Rolling Stone. And this show is and isn't about Jussie Smollett. I am not even going to give you, like, a thumbnail description of why you've heard of this person. I think I can safely assume you know why he's the topic. And Jamil and I are going to talk about why we shouldn't talk about him, what the real hate crimes are these days. So, coming right up, Jamil Smith. Jamil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm excited to have you back. Not so excited about the topic of the day, which is, yeah. I think we should talk about false crime reporting. I think that that is definitely a thing we should talk about. I have some statistics here that might help us. 70% of false crime reports are by white people citing a black suspect. An innocent black man is 7 times more likely to be found guilty of murder than an innocent white man. Half of all rape accusations that end in post-conviction exoneration stem from eyewitness accounts by white victims and witnesses identifying a black assailant. And under New York stop and frisk policy, 75% of those stopped were black or Puerto Rican. Those seem like false crime reports to me.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the first thing I thought about this morning when I saw the reports about the Chicago police superintendent going off about Jussie Smollett and whatnot. There are a few things that went through my head. Words. One is that seemed like he was being essentially tried before the fact. I think that, you know, even though this seems like an utterly reprehensible thing to do, just on its face, I think that he is, you know, do the same thing that all Americans are do, which is the presumption of innocence. Number one. And number two is that the first thing I thought about was the Legacy Museum that I visited about almost a year ago in Montgomery, Alabama. And that was opened by the Equal Justice Initiative and Brian Stevenson, its founder. And that you know, Legacy Museum honors the victims of lynching. And, you know, of course, the iconography of lynching is what surrounds this attack. You know, the rope, the bleaching, you know, the things that he used essentially, ostensibly, you know, allegedly to, you know, basically couch this attack as a racist thing, as a racist happening. And, you know, part of me wants to just say, like, look, you know, what good is prison going to do? Just, you know, force him to go down and take a look at, you know, the dirt, you know, from those lynching sites, force him to go down and look at the names on those blocks that are hanging at the memorial. You know, every county of every state where those lynchings happened, even the names that we don't know.
Yeah.
And I thought about that, but I also think in just in terms of what you're saying, the crimes, the quote unquote crimes for which these people were lynched are so often not crimes at all. Or they were crimes that actually were false accusations. And I thought about Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. You know, he's falsely accused of hitting on a white woman.
Yeah. You know?
And for that he paid for, you know, he paid for that with his life. And so many people in the history of this country have been brutally slain for the crime of simply being black and being in the wrong place and being the target of a white person's ire. You know, listen, you know, I'm not trying to forgive what Jussie Smollett has allegedly done, but I'm simply trying to put it into context.
And that's what I think my hope for this conversation was. And you mentioned false reports, you know, of the more common variety, the existing while black. And it's interesting, if you do a Google search right now, as I did, for, you know, false reporting of crime, the first hits you'll get are like the news reports, of course, right? Right. About this in Chicago. But then you start to see reports of Barbecue Becky and Permit Patty and a whole string of stories about black people calling for more attention being paid to false crime reports. You know, this is actually an issue. Like when people are like all mad about Jussie Smollett having wasted the Chicago police's time, like I'm curious, did Barbecue Becky pay a fine? Did she get a mugshot? You know, like
right.
There are people wasting the police's resources all the time by calling in crimes that aren't even crimes. Like that's right. That sort of false crime report, you know, not just making up a crime, yeah. But calling in someone for the crime of existing.
And not just wasting police resources, but potentially putting people in danger. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's a case back home in my hometown of Cleveland. This young man was mowing lawns for money in a suburb of Maple Heights and simply literally running a business, a landscape business. Young man, I think he wasn't even a teenager yet. And a white neighbor called the cops on him after he, you know, essentially, I think, mowed a little bit of her lawn. And I guess I edged a little bit of her lawn in the process of mowing part of her neighbor's lawn. And you know, you didn't call cops on a 12-year-old kid in the same town that Tamir Rice was shot in?
I was going to say, talk about another false crime report. Tamir Rice was playing with the toy gun.
Right.
And
so, yeah, I mean, this is, you're not just reporting a crime falsely. You're not just wasting the resources of the police that could be better used elsewhere. You are potentially putting someone in danger. And that to me is a much more egregious misuse of police resources than what happened with Jussie Smollett. Now, here's the thing. It's like police have to take accountability in this case for their own misuse of resources. Now, would the same amount of resources been allocated for a regular Joe who accused someone of this kind of attack? If someone hadn't been on Empire and said that they had been attacked in the early hours in a Chicago street. Would they have had all these man hours, you know, dedicated to their case? It's worth asking these questions. And I think it's, you know, all these, you know, the very first thing that the police superintendent says that I wish the victims of gun violence got this much attention. Well, you're the police superintendent. Give them that much attention.
Yeah.
It's not up to the media. It's not up to the press to give them that much attention. Yes, we can do our part. But it, I mean, it is up to the police. Give them that much attention and stop shooting them while you're at it.
I was going to say, who did more damage to Chicago's reputation, Jesse Smollett or Laquan McDonald, right? Like,
or Jason Van Dyke.
Yes, sorry, not Laquan McDonald didn't do the harm. I should say his story did that harm, and this sort of brings us around to how people. So we've covered. Yes, there is a real problem of false crime reporting. Now let's address kind of the other. Another part of this equation, which is there is a real hate crime problem.
Indeed.
I will just do some, I have some more numbers handy. There's a 17% increase in hate crime reporting last year. Just over 7,000 crimes recorded in the FBI's database. But that database is considered to be a conservative estimate. Another government bureau, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, did a survey of various populations, and their estimate for the annual number of hate crimes in America is 250,000.
Mm-hmm. And the increase in the number of hate groups continues to rise. I mean, you're thinking about the you know, and that is... not a coincidence. We're just thinking about what has just been released, revealed, I should say, in the last couple days. Mm-hmm. This member of the United States Coast Guard, Christopher Hassan, lieutenant, caught in his home with any number of guns, targeting Democrats, targeting cable news hosts, all supposed enemies of this president, referring to Senator Elizabeth Warren in a derogatory racist language that echoes that of the president.
I believe Ilhan Omar,
who is
my congressman, by the way, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, was on his list. His target list was the list of people you hear the president talking about. Like, he took his orders from our commander in chief.
Right. And in whether or not the president would like to take responsibility for that is almost irrelevant. The point is that we need to, you know, frankly, as members of the press, you know, I think it's our responsibility to draw the correlation between what the president is saying, not simply about, you know, members of Congress, but also, frankly, about us. Mm-hmm. And what people on the extreme right are doing in response. It's not simply a matter of people saying mean things to us.
Yeah.
That we can handle. People are getting guns and training to shoot people and to kill them. And that is a part of this culture that we should not have to accept.
I was going to add that Bureau of Justice Statistics survey estimates that 90% of that 250,000 hate crimes are violent crimes of some kind. And the FBI statistics are sort of interesting because FBI statistics tend to be the kinds of things that I think we may stereotypically think of as hate crimes. They get reported like the swastika on somebody's door or somebody being called a name. Like that gets coverage sometimes. But
right.
These crimes that the Bureau of Justice Statistics uncovers are interpersonal crimes, crimes in which two people kind of, you know, someone is attacked for their identity.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It's not a case of kind of social media slander or something like that. It's the very real consequences of an environment that the president, you know, incubates.
Yeah. And incubating that environment. What is he doing? He's making it okay for people to express their hatreds, for people to, you know, feel open about, you know, their various resentments. and to express those resentments violently. It's one thing to express those resentments through a vote mm-hmm. or through, you know, through various legislative actions or through protest. It is another thing to have a president who, when violent actions break out at his rallies, he openly encourages those actions. Or when violence, you know, breaks out or is, you know, suppressed, you know, thankfully by law enforcement, and that become, you know, that is revealed in the news, as it was with Lieutenant Hassan here, he says nothing mm-hmm. in response, or he calls them very, you know, so some of them are very good people or what have you. And he makes excuses for the people on his side while he demonizes the people who he needs to demonize in order to gain a political advantage and to further secure his power base. And he does this again, just to make sure that he stays where he is, to, you know, he make sure that he stays powerful. And he simply doesn't care what the consequences are. He will say that the press is the enemy of the people. All he needs to say that. He will ban transgender people from the military without, you know, worrying about what kind of consequences that may have for transgender people in the real world. I mean, let's take the focus off us in the press for a moment. Let's talk about what's happening in you know, for trans people in this world. I mean, we're talking about visible minorities here who are being targeted, who are being killed left and right. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a world in which people feel like it's just okay to discard these people's lives simply because they look different or feel like they don't belong in their, you know, they don't have the they feel like, you know, they're not as, you know, they're not born with this the gender that they have in their soul, you know, yeah. just, you know, what, however they, however, you know, people may come to determine whoever they are is how they determine who they are. And people don't seem to accept that. And they've determined that it's okay to kill people because of that. And all day after day, we see more and more, especially trans people of color, discarded without, you know, seemingly without, you know, without a care and without much notice, frankly, from the media. And that's what I worry about when I see this Jussie Smollett case is I worry about the victims that we haven't seen yet. Mm. I worry about the people who are not going to be believed, not because of Jussie, but because, you know, the people who are just waiting for an excuse to not believe people. You know what I mean? There are people who are just waiting. Like, there are people who are just rooting for this to be a lie. There are people who are saying, God, I just need one to be false so that I can just throw that and use that as the excuse to not believe. Just like you need one false rape case. They needed the Virginia case to be false so that we can just throw that out anytime a woman alleges a rape case. So we can just say, oh, no, Virginia. Nope. That's, you know, and it's the same epidemic of like, it's just, it's over and over again of this false, really stilted logic of how do we get, you know, get around these people? Like, we can't actually beat them with real logic. So we're just going to, like, you know, we're just going to say that the one case rule, it's like the one drop rule. It's like, it's unbelievable.
I think that's really good. The one case rule. It is, again, I do not plan it, but it is one of those times where I'm actually wearing the item of clothing that was sent to me by the advertiser, Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service. I've been using it for years, long before they were a sponsor. I absolutely love the concept, and I love the clothes that they send me. I used to use it as a kind of like refresher of my wardrobe. Like, I asked them to send me edgier things that I might not normally pick out. And I've kind of transitioned into, you know what, send me stuff I'm going to use for years and years and years. Send me like high quality things that may be just a little different than what I see in a store, but that I'm going to love and have in my closet for years. And they made that transition with me. They send me just as cool stuff. The thing I'm wearing right now is a cashmere turtleneck. And what's kind of cool about it is a little oversized. It has, I've forgotten the actual fashion name for it, but the bat wing sleeves, you know, like, to be frank, a kind of 80s style, but it's really cool and like high quality. And I think that it's going to last me for as long as I want to wear it. And it's a subtle batwing, by the way. God, what are they called? Dolman sleeves, I think. That's it. Anyway, Stitch Fix. You get 5 items of clothing in every box. You try them on. You pay only for what you keep and you return the rest. The styling fee is $20, which gets applied to anything that you buy. And right now, my listeners can get a special deal. You can get started at stitchfix.com/friends, and you'll get an extra $25 off when you keep all the items in your box. That's stitchfix.com/friends to get started today. I will remind you, you can get like 1 Stitch Fix ever. You can also get them regularly. You can get them quarterly. You can just sign up and then maybe every once in a while, like for a special occasion, tell them you want one. stitchfix.com/friends for an extra 25% off. Journalist Mehdi Hasan is known around the world for his televised takedowns of presidents and prime ministers. He hosts Upfront on Al Jazeera and is a columnist for The Intercept. And in his new podcast, Deconstructed, Mehdi unpacks a game-changing news event of the week while challenging the conventional wisdom in a tight 30-minute package, a little quicker than what we do here. He starts his show with his take on one topic and what the mainstream news is getting wrong or what context is being missed. And then he goes into a deep analysis in conversation with his guest or guests of the week. And get this, his guests have included Judd Apatow, Bernie Sanders, and Hasan Minhaj. So he kind of covers the gamut, I would say, in terms of who you might be expecting. It's everyone from comedians to politicians to, for instance, Stephon Clark's fiance. So you're going to hear from a lot of different people. And the show has covered such topics as the violence in Gaza from the perspective of Israeli activists against the occupation and, of course, police shootings as through the eyes of the fiance of Stephon Clark. Also, he's talked about the dangers of John Bolton with former diplomats. As a Brit and a Muslim and immigrant based in Donald Trump's Washington, D.C., Mehdi Hasan gives a refreshingly provocative perspective on the ups and downs of American and global politics. Deconstructed is a show that cuts through political drivel and media misinformation to give you a straight take on one big news story of the week. It is out every Friday, just like this pod. You can listen and subscribe at theintercept.com/deconstructed or on any podcast platform. I wanted to point out that this is insidious and institutional, right? Like the default position of law enforcement and of our culture is that, you know, people of color are guilty. That is how they approach those situations. There was a fascinating study that I read about the disproportionate, you know, number of false crime reports, and it got into kind of the logic of why white people are more likely to make any kind of crime report. And it's because even if a white person has a negative interaction or unwanted interaction with the police, they tend to see that interaction as proof that the police are doing their job. They actually can walk away from that interaction thinking, well, they misidentified me as guilty, but thank God the police are around. Because, you know, those interactions probably, let's face it, just aren't as often fatal to white people.
Yeah, I was going to say they don't see a whole lot of of white bodies perforated on the news. You know, and that when you don't have that experience, and when I say that experience, I don't mean that lived experience in your own body, but I say that it's more of a cultural experience that's passed down. I mean, we wonder sometimes, as Black folks, why our relatives, our older relatives, have been so paranoid, or why they are so reticent to trust folks, particularly white people, and you know, because we grow up in more, you know, integrated environments. We grow up, you know, our entertainment is more integrated. Our schools are more integrated. We hang around more white people. And, you know, we instinctively, I guess, you know, we're more inclined to trust, I guess you could say.
Wow.
And some of us, like it's, and, you know, there's some older folks that are like, yeah, I'm a lot more scarred by what happened. And then you learn and you listen to their stories and you understand, you know, when you live through Jim Crow,
yeah.
You know, you can understand why, you know, you can understand. And then now I think we're getting a little bit more of a taste of that. And frankly, I think the Trump era is giving the entire country a taste of just how flawed this country is. I think everybody, white, black, you know, no matter what ethnicity you are getting a taste of just how flawed this country is. And, you know, I think it is.
I think it
might be the only thing that's actually instructive about this time.
Yeah, no, I believe, you know, for better or worse, and it's obviously for worse, this is the presidency that we deserved on some level. And if anything good is going to come of it, it's going to come from seeing ourselves in the mirror. And I guess I should say as a white person, seeing the country for what it really is. And I actually want to talk a little bit about lived experience because, you said it's not necessarily like your personal lived experience, but I want to ask you about your personal lived experience because you and I got to know each other in the halcyon days of 2015, 2016. those were more optimistic times, better times. And I remember even then learning from you more about kind of like everyday racism, you know?
Yeah.
Like the experience of just having to cross the street when some, you know, if a white woman like looks at you funny, right?
Right. Or just more accurately, I just don't feel like dealing with this today.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sometimes I do it just because I don't feel like dealing with this.
Right. That's, and I remember that story you telling me, just like, it's not like you're worried. It's more just like, I want to not have this. And it just, I don't even want to have to think about it. Right.
Right. Yep.
So I know my lived experience in a post-Trump, or I guess Trump era, we're not post-Trump yet, post-Trump election, mid-Trump era, maybe, I have seen more everyday racism. I see white people emboldened. I can tell you stories, right, about people I know who I knew were conservative, I knew had, let's say, retrograde views about race, but I'd never heard them say something overtly racist. I've now heard those people say things that are overtly racist. And I'm wondering, because we haven't caught up, you know, a lot. And I'm wondering if this is something that you, in these past 2 years, is this happening from your point of view, too?
Well, I mean, I haven't had folks confront me with overt racism.
Well, no, that doesn't happen. You know, that's only going to happen in the company of safe white people, right? Like, that's...
Well, yeah, and I'm also a black man of reasonable size. I mean, people, they're wise enough to know that, you know, they don't want a confrontation.
Right.
But at the same time, I think that, you know, it's always interesting to talk to my white friends about this because, you know, to a certain degree, you guys are our secret agents.
Uh-huh. I mean,
you know, you hear what we're never going to be told.
Right.
And I remember writing a column once about how, you know, essentially it's your responsibilities, especially around like holiday time, to speak to your relatives about, you know, about these kinds of racism, about dealing with this. Because, frankly, I don't have these struggles at my holiday table. You know, I sit around at Thanksgiving and there are no racial conflicts. You know what I mean? There are no political, you know, tete-a-tetes. You know, we're pretty much all on the same page.
You know, that's something I've heard over and over from people of color who've been guests on this show, basically saying, take care of your people, right? Mao Bell sometimes talks about like it being racial solidarity in a good way, like white people need to police white people.
Right.
I used the word police there, I guess, with some sense of irony.
Yes, in the actual proper sense of the term.
Yeah. And I wonder, because, you know, you and I both, I think one of the things that is exciting, also a thing that's happened in journalism that I find exciting, is that we talk more about like what people can do. Like, we're not just talking about the news, right? Like you talked about the media needing to be conscious. And I also think that I want to call on my fellow well-meaning white people to, when someone is racist in front of you, say something. But I think this is actually like pretty important to point out that the hate crimes that we're talking about and the false reports that we're talking about happen in part because of the president, yes. But they also happen in part because good white people say nothing, you know? They happen because, you know, you were talking, you were speaking very passionately and correctly about the incredibly tragic consequences of trans discrimination. I know that there are people who feel uncomfortable talking about trans issues. It's because it just like weirds them out or something. So if a joke is made or a position, they're asked about their position on it, maybe they don't say something, right? Like, this stuff exists in our everyday conversations.
Yeah.
And we have some responsibility there.
Yeah. And I think, anyhow, to a large degree, I listen, I mean, there's points in all of our lives where we have to get over ourselves, you know. There was a point early in my life, you know, I had to sort of get over myself when it came to, you know, homophobia. You know, I think there's a point where a lot of us had to get over ourselves with regards to different aspects of, you know, cultural biases and whatnot. But, I think that, we are all grownups at this point. And, if being conversant about trans issues weirds you out, I really don't have a lot of sympathy for you at this point. People are out here dying. You know, people are out here being abused and bullied. And it's simply because of who they are. It's simply because they are existing. And we have a government in place that is now legislating that bullying, essentially. We have a government in place that is legitimizing that through policy and is saying that it's okay to do this because these people are different. We're saying it's okay to exclude them from the military, to tell them where they can use the restroom, to basically, marginalize them from different parts of society because of who they are, because of who they love, and because of how they identify. At some point, they are going to come for you, too. Just keep that in mind.
I think this might be a good place to take a break for a second, let people kind of marinate with that. We'll be right back. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data and place a trade in just 4 taps on your phone. You can also view stock collections, such as the 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners to With Friends Like These a free stock, like Apple, Ford, or Sprint, to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at crookedfriends.robinhood.com. That's crookedfriends.robinhood.com. I love that I've been given this ad to read to you because it says something about the new year, and here we are in February, almost March, and I want to remind you yet again, January 1st is just another date on the calendar. You can choose to establish a new habit. You can make a New Year's resolution any day you want. That can be the first day of your year of doing it. And when it comes to your physical and mental health, why wait? That's why we're excited to partner with Calm, the number one app to help you sleep, meditate, and relax. If you go to calm.com/friends, you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programs, including guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, and a brand new meditation every day called The Daily Calm. There's also Sleep Stories, which I confess I haven't used, but I'm so intrigued. They are bedtime stories for adults designed to help you relax before you doze off. Head to the lavender fields of France with Stephen Fry or explore New Zealand with Jerome Flynn from Game of Thrones. They also have Bob Ross talking. It sounds delightful. There's also soothing music, breathing exercises, gentle stretches to relax your body, and more. Again, for a limited time, with friends like these, listeners get 25% off a Calm premium subscription. If you go to calm.com/friends, that's calm.com/friends, get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today at calm.com/friends. Give yourself the gift of calm. And we're back. Jamil, I actually want to return to that idea that, you know, all of us, I think many of us experience the oppression of this administration in one way or another. And that has actually put me in mind of something I saw you tweeting about. I'm going to ask you to expand about, which is that Ralph Northam has had something of a rebound in the polls. Now, you connect those two. I think you see where I'm going. So
Yes, I do.
Please. Expand.
So, as there's been a couple polls recently that have shown that Ralph Northam enjoys a fairly significant advantage amongst African American Virginians in terms of favorability. Previous poll had him at 58% of favorability amongst African Americans who say that he should remain in office. A new poll that Politico reported on earlier today, this being Thursday, said that about 56, if I remember correctly, 56% of African Americans believe that he should remain in office. Now, Politico reported this rather uncritically. They essentially positioned this as saying that he has recovered from the scandal, that he has weathered the storm. And I thought that that was a rather ridiculous way to position this. Mm-hmm. I thought that it certainly did not take into account the fact that African Americans throughout, frankly, American history have had to be pragmatic about how we use our politics. And I think Virginians right now, particularly African-American Virginians, have to be extraordinarily pragmatic because Ralph Northam refuses to resign. Justin Fairfax, the lieutenant governor, refuses to resign despite being credibly accused by two women of sexual violence. The attorney general, Mark Herring, refuses to resign despite admitting himself to having dabbled in blackface when he was 19.
You make it sound like a hobby. Dabbled.
Well,
just dabbled a bit.
Well, considering, I love how it was once described as dark makeup.
Dark makeup and Times. Dabbling. I dabbled in dark makeup.
And yes. And the fact that, you know, I mean, Northam actually had a chance to weather the storm credibly had he just simply apologized at the beginning and mm-hmm. said, look, I put a picture of myself either as a Sambo or as a Klansman, one of the two. He still hasn't identified himself as either one on my yearbook page. I was also nicknamed Coon Man for a particular reason that I still haven't yet explained. And I apologize unreservedly for this, it being in my past. And I look to, you know, make amends in any way possible and look to engage in a, you know, respectful and open dialogue about all of that. And he could have done that. He could have done that. But instead, he tried to do the 180 and pull the Shaggy defense and say, it wasn't me.
What I find fascinating about that is that he basically is doing the I need to learn more and I want to start a dialogue thing without having admitted he did something wrong. It's weird. It's like,
yeah. Well,
he said like, or he admits to the Michael Jackson thing, but somehow I think still hasn't really fully like grappled with that. I want to make really clear the point I was making about the system of oppression that a lot of us are feeling in this so-called, you know, this apparent rebound in Northam's polling, which is that we sometimes cannot be picky about our allies, unfortunately. Like,
right.
I hate this so much. I hate it. And this is actually a theme of the program that right. you might sometimes have. When do we decide to be picky? That's actually the question that I think about a lot. Is when right. do we decide an ally has crossed a line? I, for one, would have thought that blackface was crossing a line, but.
Oh, blackface certainly crossed the line. I mean, Northam should have resigned.
Yeah.
Northam, to me, lost all credibility. He lost all moral credibility to govern
mm-hmm.
The moment that yearbook page showed up.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a yearbook page with your name on it, that you ostensibly controlled, and it has a picture of a smiling Sambo next to a guy in a Klan outfit. I mean, we should not forget the Ku Klux Klan is a terrorist group. That's not something that, you know, you dress up as a Halloween costume. You know, this is something that's a very serious thing. And it was not handled either in, you know, certainly in that photo or in the apology with the seriousness that it required. And he should have resigned. But here's the rub. If he resigns, then you have Justin Fairfax. Well, here's the guy who's credibly accused of sexual violence. Well, if he resigns, then you have Mark Herring. Again, blackface. If he resigns, well, then you have a Republican Speaker of the House. And then he becomes the governor of Virginia. And a lot of Democrats, especially Black Democrats in Virginia, do not want that to happen. And you can understand why they may be willing to essentially suck it up for the one term. They are term limited in Virginia to one term. Suck it up for the one term that Ralph Northam has to serve and get whatever Democratic policies that he's willing to offer up. I mean, it does seem like he's ready and willing to do Black folks' bidding. he's going to just do whatever. I mean, he's going to do everything, looks like, short of reparations to maintain their favor. And, you know, they may be willing to, you know, squeeze that orange as much as they can to just make sure that they get whatever concessions they can to make, you know, to essentially help.
Who'd have thought that would be how it worked out, right? Who'd have thought that what we need is more people who have a clearly racist acts in their past, and we'll just get them.
It's astonishing, really, yeah. To be honest with you. But, I mean, you know, if you just apologetic racist Democrats, maybe that's the new...
Speaking of Elizabeth Warren...
Oh, Senator Warren, I do not ascribe to that description. No.
Well, actually, it also, you know what? I'm not calling her racist. And actually, I should be clear on this show in general. Like, I do try to not call people racist. I mean, I guess maybe we do, but people exist within a system of white supremacy, right? And I think what Elizabeth Warren is guilty of, to the extent she's guilty in a whole, you know, can talk about that too, it's that she participated in that system when she, you know, ta-da, unveiled her Indian heritage, Native American heritage, right? Like, she was not acknowledging the damage that white supremacy has done to that population, mm-hmm. and in fact was perpetuating right. certain stereotypes. But... I think she might be the only presidential candidate who's now actively listening to Native peoples, right? Like, that's now part of her campaign. So there's that. And also I was going to say, she came out today in favor of reparations. So, you know, I mean, if what we That's have to compelling. Do is find white people who feel really guilty about shit in order to like move the ball forward, like, and it's maybe it's not like woke, well-meaning white people who are going to move the ball forward as far as undoing white supremacy. Maybe it's kind of relatively unwoke white people who feel super guilty who are going to move the ball right. forward. That's my
well,
new theory.
Here's the thing. I do it is as amused as I am, I do think that white guilt has a short shelf life.
Okay, we got to do what we can then. We got to like act.
I think white guilt does have I think it has a shelf life in as much as it proves politically expedient. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the moment we become outnumbered as marginalized people, then that guilt subsides magically. I mean, there's a story in the Times that said that, you know, Democratic voters went on the trail don't seem to care much about this Native American story.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that reflects in the deep recesses of Senator Warren's consciousness. I've had off the record conversations with the senator about this, which I will not share, but out of respect for that confidence. But I mean, she has read my piece about this, my criticisms, and is, you know, I know that she has taken those to heart, and we've had respectful conversations about it. But my thing is, I do feel that just to conclude on that, I do feel like she has apologized eventually in the way that she should have apologized.
Yes. Yes. I want to be clear. Like, I do not need to say that she is racist.
No. I know that. I know that.
Yeah.
But I know that was unjust.
And she also illuminated the issue in a way that hasn't, you know, really been on front pages before, right? Like,
right. Not necessarily the way that we need to,
right?
Or maybe that indigenous communities would have preferred, but certainly it was illuminated. Now, what we need is for that illumination to manifest in policy improvements that benefit those communities, and that's the rub. And so, you know, I think that, you know, these flashpoints of identity conflict, you know what I mean? That these flashpoints of white guilt that manifest themselves in headlines and an apology in campaigns, they need to manifest themselves in more than just these moments of, you know, that of rhetoric. They need to manifest in policy proposals that become real things. And I think, frankly, folks are a little bit jaded, and rightfully so. They've been burned. And I just think the folks are going to need to see a little bit more from folks other than saying, you know, they're saying, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I think that, you know, that's I think it's a big reason, frankly, that Joe Biden has not entered the race. They would need to hear a lot more than I'm sorry for Anita Hill and a lot of other stuff than. You know, they're going to need to hear a lot more than that. And I think, frankly, you know, it may be a reason why some folks didn't show up for Hillary Clinton, you know, in 2016. Because
definitely.
Like, oh, well, you know, like, well, I mean, not just because of super predators necessarily, but maybe because, oh, hey, you may be saying all this great stuff about race. You know, you may be telling white people to get involved in the struggle for racial progress and all that. But we've been burned too many times before. I'm sorry, you know.
And I think you and I had this conversation. I had this conversation with many people after the election, and talking about how our largely white mainstream media sort of missed Trump. And I believe it was our own Ira Madison that put it to me this way, which is that if you tell people of color that the big danger with the other candidate is that person's a racist, it's hard to consider that like new or alarming. right? Like,
and that nerve has essentially been deadened with Trump because it's become a daily occurrence. You know, when that has become manifest in one of the most insidious policies in family separation. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen it manifest in this extraordinarily evil policy that's actually, you know, separated families, that's put people in incarcerated children. Mm-hmm. It's actually done that. We've seen it. It's tough for people to, you know, I mean, you know, there's only so much I think people are willing to process. And frankly, I think the danger is that some people start to tune it out. And that is my concern going into 2016 or 2020 is that, you know, people start to tune it out to a point where they, just are not animated enough about what is going on. And this cat skates by.
And weirdly, it would be a repeat of 2016. You know, it would just be because there's another way to put the critique that Ira was making of Hillary Clinton is that, like, if you don't elect me, a racist will be in the White House just wasn't like enough of an argument for a lot of African-Americans, because, frankly, there have been so many racists in the White House. Like, why?
Right.
You know,
you're going to tell somebody who saw Lyndon Johnson to say, you know, like, you know, don't put a racist in the White House.
Right.
I can understand that would be, not necessarily the most persuasive thing. But now that they have seen the genuine article, who knows?
Except, as you said, it's just now we hear it so much. A lot of us may become deadened to it. Although maybe the problem this time is that, you know, a bunch of well-meaning white people are deadened to it. Like, if you can animate people of color to, like, really, you know, mobilize and come out and vote and everything, then you just run up the totals in the blue states, right?
Right. And also, again, the problem is potentially a purity test on the left. Mm-hmm. If the right person, the correct person, I should say, on the left for certain people is not nominated, do people stay home? You know? My job as a journalist is not to help these people win elections. My job is to hold these people accountable. I told these people this to their faces. But it just doesn't seem that difficult. It's just about telling people the truth about what they're going to do for them. And you're not going to win these Trump voters over. So stop trying to win them over. Okay? Stop. Just stop it. If you do win over some of them and then some of them grow a conscience and some of them realize how they're getting screwed, great. That's good for you. Like, that's an ancillary benefit. You have enough people to win the election. You do. You already do. So go get those folks and turn them out. Like, it's just not, it's that elementary. And if you do that, you can go ahead and win. And part of that is, it has to be fundamental to your strategy, is fighting voter suppression, period. You know, it's doing things like what we're seeing in North Carolina's 9th district right now, which is challenging, you know, these blatant attempts to jimmy the vote, the election results. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to happen. We're already seeing it.
To bring full circle, by the way, talk about your false crime reports. The allegations of voter fraud that Republicans make against Democrats, those are your false crime reports. You know, this idea of voter fraud being something that's needs to be policed, whereas we've seen what voter fraud looks like. It looks like North Carolina. And it's not about showing ID at the polls, right? So.
Right. And it's so bad in North Carolina that the Republican candidate himself is actually calling for the new election. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's a tide turning. There's an awareness growing in this country of just how many faults that we have. This country was drastically unprepared for a president like Donald Trump. And I think that, you know, the weaknesses have been exposed. The wounds have been you know, a lot of wounds have been reopened, but a lot of wounds that we like to cover up with American exceptionalism and a lack of critical thinking have been exposed anew. And we just need to, you know, frankly, go about bandaging them up. And we need to, frankly, pick somebody who's going to go about doing the best job of that in the next 4 years and beyond. And that's what we need to be worried about. We did not somebody who's going to fill our heads up with a bunch of bullshit, but somebody who's going to go about the very, very immediate project of trying to fix this country and get it, you know, frankly, start the repairing process. And, you know, I think that this country is capable of a lot of great things. I still believe in the American project, but I think, frankly, a lot of people thought, you know, had a miscalculation. They thought it was a lot further along than it actually was. And Donald Trump's election, I think, is a corrective in that regard.
Okay. That's a good place for us to end, I believe. I think there was some optimism. There was definitely optimism in that. So I want to end there. Thank you so much for being here on short notice.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's it for the show this week. Sort of in the spirit of how this show, you know, was and was not about Jesse Smollett, I want to offer a thought that I've had lately, which is that it is okay to not have an opinion on something. It is okay to just let some news stories be. I know in today's world of social media, it is so tempting to have an opinion on everything, but I have found it incredibly helpful to remember that my opinions can be formed after I read other people's. And that, again, actually, sometimes maybe my opinion isn't really the point. There are lots of people whose voices should be heard about Jesse Smollett. I'm not sure that mine is one of them. That's why we didn't talk about the case specifically. I think there are a lot of other voices out there that I would like to hear from and that you can find, who can speak more to the experience of queer people of color, of people who have actually experienced hate crimes, of people who have survived. I encourage you to look at the With Friends Like These back catalog for some of those voices. Parker Malloy, Charlotte Clymer, and Arjun Sethi are just three. Remember, you can listen to those shows and feel what you feel and think what you think, but you don't have to have an opinion. Not just yet. And that is it for this week. Please, please, take care of yourselves.